And thanks for joining us. I'm Frank Sesno, host of Planet Forward, director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University, sitting in for Diane Rehm today. And we've got quite an agenda. The worst oil spill in U.S. history may be nearing its end. Finally, BP Gulf Oil, BP's well in the Gulf, has been rendered static. And yesterday, the government released a new report saying about three-quarters of the oil has been collected, dispersed, or otherwise eliminated. Well, joining us in the studio to talk about these developments is Joel Achenbach of The Washington Post. Joining us from KPFT in Houston is Barbara Shook of the Energy Intelligence Group. And hello to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to have you both, and it's great actually after all these weeks and months to actually have something good or better to talk about. Joel, why don't you lead us off today? The plugging really begins.
You know, I think we're ready for this thing to be over. In fact, in reporting the story today that ran in the Washington Post, I kept thinking, do I just want it to be over? I have to guard against the bias that, you know, this disaster has overstayed its welcome, particularly for people on the Gulf Coast. Obviously, it's been a tragic event. And it does look like that we're at another turning point. The big turning point was July 15th when they closed the valves on this new capping stack that they had lowered on July 12th. And when they closed those valves, gone was the plume that had been a fixture of TV for almost the whole summer.
That spewing picture.
That ugly oil. Black oil geyser, which was always on, the cable TV and on the internet. And there were these spill cams where you could just constantly watch this thing gushing. But what happened, late Tuesday is they started the static kill and they shoved mud down the well. And it appeared to go exactly as they hoped.
So, and I want to read the words of your piece today, your article. On the 107th day of the Deepwater Horizon disaster, you write, the Macondo well became an apparently harmless hole in the seafloor clogged with 13-pound-per-gallon gunk and barely more of a threat to spew oil in the Gulf of Mexico than to start gushing lemonade. Where did that come from?
I don't know. The thing about it is it's not technically dead, okay? And if you listen to Thad Allen, he all but orders you to remain vigilant and don't start celebrating. It's not really over because they have to go in with a relief well. But right now as we speak, they are either preparing or they've just started the cementing. Now, after you send in the mud, you send in the cement. And this was a decision they had to make, whether to try to cement it from the top. There were some arguments on both sides. The federal scientists, I think, were a little more reluctant. But if they go in with the cement and this thing is plugged with cement, it's really pretty darn dead.
It's really plugging the hole. Barbara Shook, summarize that government report that we got yesterday. That's the part that Joel was talking about that says more dispersed than maybe we thought.
Yes, and I have a few problems with the government report. The government report says that about 75% of all the oil that was gushed from this hole in the bottom of the ocean has been dispersed, eaten by the microbes in the Gulf of Mexico, dissolved by the dispersants that were poured into the water to basically chemically eliminate it. Are evaporated by the heat of the Gulf of Mexico waters and the heat of the environment down here. I don't think that these factors eliminated that much oil.
You don't buy the report's bottom line then?
No, I don't buy the report's bottom line. I think that a good bit of the oil has been eliminated, but you've still got underwater plumes that contain an enormous volume that they have not been able to track completely. Some of these plumes are lighter liquids that came up with the natural gas. They keep talking about just the oil. Well, a huge amount of the hydrocarbons that came up from the Macondo well were natural gas and natural gas liquids. And they just did not keep track of the natural gas.
Well, Barbara, are you suggesting that in this government report that was released with much fanfare yesterday here in Washington, that facts are being deliberately either misconstrued or kept out, or is it they simply don't know? I mean, what is your suggestion?
I think they simply don't know, because you can't put natural gas in a can quite as easily as you can oil. It's very hard to measure. It's very hard to contain. You either contain it immediately or you don't contain it at all. That's the problem with the gas. You can't control it as easily as you can a liquid. And when it has liquids mixed with it, as this gas did, it just escapes into the water. And it's going to create dead zones, just like the natural gas that washes down the Mississippi every year in the form of fertilizer runoff creates dead zones in the water. And I think these are things that are going to have to be looked after, monitored closely in the Gulf of Mexico in the years to come. We have the fertilizer dead zones. We may have the methane dead zones that are associated with the liquids from the Macondo spill.
Joel, you're somebody who's been watching this very closely. You know the report. You share this skepticism and doubt about the bottom line in that report?
I think everyone who follows this should be aware of the uncertainties involved, and that this report, you know, the danger is that it sounds like three-quarters of it is gone.
Yeah, it sounds wasn't so bad after all.
Well, first of all, let's put this into perspective. Something like 205 million gallons of oil gushed from this well. Even if this report is exactly spot on, we're still talking about even a quarter of that amount is equivalent to about 5 Exxon Valdezes. So it's still a lot of oil. Moreover, the report itself is based on modeling. It's based on extrapolation. It's based on some sort of novel scientific guesswork that to put too much faith in the exactitude of this thing, I think, would be a mistake. And finally, there's the fact that although they said three quarters is gone, a large chunk of that is as your other guest said, is dispersed in the water both naturally and chemically, but it's still there. So I think that's the question, is maybe they would have been better off saying half of it is gone and half of it is still there.
Barbara Shook, back to you. 4.9 million barrels of oil flowed from the wellhead between April 22nd and July 15th. 1.8 million gallons of chemical dispersants were applied to dilute the stuff and make it disappear. You put that mix together, you know, as Joel said, even if it's just a quarter of the oil that's left, that's still a lot of stuff churning around out there. What do we know about what's happening? I mean, scientifically, what's happening to marine life now, and where is this headed in the months and years to come?
Well, we really don't know, because we've never had an event of this magnitude. It's much larger than the Exxon Valdez. It's much larger than the Ixtoc 1 well blowout in Mexico in 1979. And I'm not sure the scientists had the opportunity to study that, because I don't think the Mexican authorities allowed them to. So we've never had the opportunity to study the impact on the environment. The Exxon Valdez incident occurred in an entirely different ecosystem, much colder, and an entirely different type of crude oil, much heavier, much less likely to disperse easily. The air was colder, the water was colder, the crude was heavier.
And has there ever been this much dispersant, this much chemical applied like this?
No, and never been this much dispersant applied either. The chemists, the scientists say that it's safe. I think somebody maybe even drank some of it to prove that it was safe to drink. Say it wasn't going to have an impact on the ecosystem in a major way. But we don't know. We don't know what's going to happen to fish who consume this in the food chain. We don't know to what degree it's going to be absorbed into the food chain. We're going to have to observe this, not just for a few seasons, but for a few decades to see what happens.
Yeah,
Going to have major environmental impacts from storms. We don't know how that's going to stir up the water and how these things are going to be dispersed more widely throughout the Gulf.
Joel Achenbach.
Yeah, Barbara, I want to agree in part, and but also discuss the whole issue of the Ixtoc spill. Now, that was 138 million gallons officially. It was in shallow water in the southern Gulf. And you're right, that there was not the level of scientific scrutiny. I was told by one of the scientists who worked on that from Texas A&M that they you know, had a symposium to discuss the scientific effects of it, but the proceedings were never published. The Mexican government was not eager to let this information get out. But that said, the Ixtoc spill had mixed results. For a couple of years, it had, you know, direct dramatic effects on beaches all the way up to Texas. In fact, a lot of the small organisms were, you know, killed off in the shallow water and right up on the beach. But the, you know, it didn't kill the Gulf. You know, it wasn't the end of the world for the Gulf, because it is a pretty resilient ecosystem. So I think the question here with this event, it's bigger than Ixtoc. It's also different because it's at depth. It's also different because of the dispersants, as you brought up. And, I mean, no one's ever, you know, done this kind of scientific experiment before. What happens when you hit all this oil with all these chemicals? But I think that, you know, all told, it's still an encouraging sign that we're not seeing the level of mortality of wildlife that we were worried about a couple of months ago.
And let me just bring in Jane Lubchenco, the head of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, who says there's absolutely no evidence that there's any significant concentration of oil that's out there that we haven't accounted for. We'll have more on the oil spill. We'll also invite your calls and your questions. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. And welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. We're talking about the Gulf oil spill, and now that the well is being plugged, what it means for the future of drilling and the future of marine life in the Gulf of Mexico and beyond. If you'd like to join our conversation, if you have any questions or comments, you can join us at 1-800-433-8850, or you can send us an email at drshow@wamu.org. Joel Achenbach, back to you. We see this report yesterday, but part of the backdrop to this is that analysts were wrong about so much for so long.
We're all snake bit by everything in this case. First of all, it dragged on the spill, the gusher just kept gushing for months. So many of the things they tried with the first containment dome, it got clogged with methane hydrates and sort of floated away. They tried this riser insertion tool, which worked a tiny bit but didn't really make a real difference. They, of course, tried the top kill in late May, and that was a bust. 3 days of pumping mud didn't work because it all flew out the top. They finally got this top hat on there, which, you know, was an impressive engineering achievement in the context of trying to do deep-sea plumbing. But we now know that all of these containment strategies – flaring gas at the surface, capturing it with the top hat, accounted for only about 1/6 of the oil that came out of that well. So to the extent that this is going to be solved, it's not going to be with technology or with skimmers or with burning at the surface. It's going to be with the natural processes of the Gulf of Mexico.
Barbara, I want you to come back to marine life for just a minute, because one other thing that Jane Lubchenco talked about yesterday, head of NOAA, was what we really don't know is the impact of this on the larva, on the next generations of marine life. Can we study that? You said we'd have to watch this not just for years, but for decades. Is there any way to get a short-run sense of what's rippling through the food chain here? I mean, we all eat seafood and other seafood from that area. How would we know if it's safe or what's in it?
Well, the seafood is all being tested, and the first test is the smell test, to be the simplest test of all, just smelling the seafood as it comes up. And so far, I think they've had very few problems with the seafood that's been brought up. Now, things like clams and oysters, those were just beginning to recover from the damage from Hurricanes Katrina. I merged these because they just go into one, Katrina and Rita, from 5 years ago. And so it will take another 5 years for those to recover. Further out, the concern is over amberjack, bluefin tuna. The larger fish that were in the reproductive cycle when this happened. As far as I know, none of the whales that had just recently been found in the Gulf of Mexico were affected. The pods swam away from the oil. They seemed to know where the periphery was, and they stayed on the periphery or further out.
Okay.
A few porpoises were affected, but none of the large mammals in the water, as far as I know, were affected.
Okay, Barbara, I want to bring in Dr. Samantha Joy now. She's a professor in the Department of Marine Sciences at the University of Georgia, and she's been researching underwater oil plumes in the Gulf oil spill. Dr. Joy, what can you add to, and we'll come back to a number of things with you here, but what can you add to what we know about marine life at this time?
Well, we've certainly seen a dramatic stimulation of microbial activity in the deep water that's been impacted by the oil and gas infusion from the leaking wellhead. I think at this point, we have a good bit of data that was collected right after or, you know, early on within the first 6 to 8 weeks of the spill, showing very, very elevated rates of metabolism. Now, those rates of metabolism draw down oxygen concentrations, but measurements haven't really been made out there in a couple of months, so we don't really know what the deep water oxygen fields are like.
Why haven't measurements been made in a couple of months?
Well, the NOAA ships that were out there were focusing efforts primarily within 5 kilometers of the wellhead, because they were, among other things, tracking the dispersant, and that's where the dispersant concentrations were the highest. I really don't know why more far-field measurements haven't been made. By far-field, I mean, 10 kilometers and out from the wellhead, because those are the areas where we saw the largest depletions of oxygen. In terms of independent scientists, a lot of different people were funded to do work related to the oil spill, but there weren't a lot of people working on the plumes specifically looking at respiration rates, for example, and oxygen consumption rates and gas and oil dynamics and these features. For some reason, we were lucky to get out there in May and June. We were hoping to get some more data in late June, early July, but we couldn't get access close into the wellhead, and we're going back out later this month.
Okay, Dr. Joy, hold your thought. I want to come back to you, because we're also joined on the phone now by Bob Deans. He's the Federal Communications Director at the Natural Resources Defense Council. He flew over the region yesterday, and I understand you've been out today on a boat looking it over and seeing it. What is your take?
Hey, Frank. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm actually in one of the biggest estuaries in America right now, Barataria Bay, an area rich in oysters, shrimp, speckled trout, crabs. And we are looking at spartinograss wetlands 20, 30 feet of the front lines of the foundations of life out here that has been destroyed by this oil. It has just gone black. It looks almost like it's been burned, set on fire. There are miles of boom around me. There are a couple of dozen boats out here. skimming, scooping up oil, doing the best they can. But of course, this is the foundation of life for the Gulf of Mexico.
So let me just jump in to be clear here. What you're seeing, you're telling us now, is continued oil activity and oil skimming.
Absolutely. It's up here in this big estuary, and of course we're in southern Louisiana off the Mississippi Delta, home to 40% of the nation's wetlands. And as you know, this is the foundation of life for the Gulf of Mexico. 97% of the marine life species in the Gulf of Mexico depend at one point or another in their life cycle on this estuary. And this is where I'm looking at oil, blackened spartina grass that is dead. And this is the matrix. This is where life begins for shrimp, crab.
Well, let me ask a question, Mr. Deans. Obviously, Barataria Bay is an incredibly rich estuary, and it's a crucial, you know, spawning ground and so on. But do you feel as though this environmental calamity is as bad as people feared 2 months ago? Because I've been down there, too, and obviously there's a lot of bays and a lot of estuaries for hundreds of miles there, and some of them have been spared this event. So it would seem to me, as a newspaper reporter, that the worst has not come true. What's your analysis of that?
Well, I'll go to the analysis of what some of the oystermen have told me, which is I was out here in early May, and an oysterman pulled up an oyster, and he said, this is what we've been waiting for since Katrina. For 5 years, we've been counting on this harvest, and if this oil comes in here, these oysters are going to die. The oil's in here. I talked to him last week. He said, my oysters are dead. That's the analysis. I don't know what various reporters were expecting.
Well, it's not to be argumentative here, but it's to try to put in perspective the dimension of this disaster and the actual aftermath that we're dealing with. We knew that there was going to be a lot of damage when that oil plume was going up out of the ground there. The question is, have these dispersants worked? Is it as bad, not as bad as we anticipated? Because now comes the final cleanup and recovery effort, which we know is going to be a long-term deal.
Well, I think it depends on who you're talking to. If you're talking to fishermen who have just had their 2010 season wiped out, they're going to tell you this is about as bad as it gets, and they're very worried about the future when you talk about Gulf restoration efforts. I talked to a fisherman last night. He said, as I'm going through the bay, I'm seeing behind my boat oil churning up. It's on the bottom. It's in the sediment. This estuary is like a sponge. It soaks this oil up. They are really concerned not only about having lost this season. They're concerned about the next season. They're concerned about their children's season. They're concerned about the future of this estuary and the way of life down here.
Dr. Joy, what's your perspective on this issue?
Well, I agree. I think, you know, there's a tremendous amount of oil in the system still. And, you know, if you look at the numbers in the report yesterday, the residual fraction, the dissolved or dispersed fraction, it's equivalent to about 13 Exxon Valdez oil spills. That's a tremendous amount of oil. To say that the problem is past and we're in, you know, the recovery phase, we're not. The impacts are going to continue. And we have a lot of work to do as a scientific community to figure out and understand the impacts on all aspects of the system, from the open water to the coastal zone.
And, of course, Barbara Shook, one of the big concerns, one of the very big concerns of people from the Gulf is that folks are going to say, problem solved, we've been through the worst, and BP and the government and others are going to pack up and leave before a lot of this research is done and before the cleanup is complete.
Well, and if I can say from the region, Frank, the concern here is kind of we've seen this movie before.
Right.
And the lesson from Katrina was it's after the storm goes through, the damage persists, and that's when the region needs the assistance most.
Barbara Shook?
I don't think that's the attitude of the other oil companies. If you look at what ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and Shell, and I think there's another company now that wants to get in. Yes, Statoil, the Norwegian state oil company, to have ready to go what they call a marine well containment corporation, a nonprofit organization, so that they have a rapid response organization in the event something like this ever happens again. But these are the companies that excluded BP from their operation because they are the companies that intend to never have to call on the nonprofit group they've organized. They're spending $1 billion to put it together. They have all of them are focusing on safety. They're the ones that are going to be cleaning up. They're the ones that are going to be funding the scientific studies for people like Dr. Joy to ensure that nothing is overlooked.
I just want to drop in a couple of comments we've gotten from our listeners at on our Facebook page and elsewhere. One from Annette: the EPA is still collecting surface water and sediment samples from impacted areas. Hard to assess the full picture until all of their sample results are back. That's a question. What about the hydrocarbon gases that make up 40% of the carbon from the well? From Dan: the federal government's report supposedly is 4 pages long with no references. This does not inspire confidence. And we've got others and phone calls standing by, which we'll get to in just a minute and continue the conversation. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're talking today about the oil spill and its aftermath. And I want to go to Joel Achenbach quickly for a question I know you've got for Dr. Joy, and then we're going to go to the calls.
Yeah, thanks, Frank. Dr. Joy, I was just curious what your opinion was of the federal report that came out yesterday and the methodology and how accurate you think it is.
Well, I think there, you know, when you look at the hard numbers, the only value that's very well constrained is the recovery value. The rest of the numbers are based on model estimates and approximations. And the biggest issue in my mind is that, you know, we really the residual fraction isn't the only oil in the system. The dissolved and dispersed material is also in the system. And it's a complex mixture. It breaks down at different rates, and we can't assume it's all going to be gone tomorrow.
Did you hear Dr. Lubchenco yesterday discuss the report, and do you think that she was sort of downplaying the danger of these dispersed oil droplets?
Well, I think, you know, we don't really have a feel for what concentrations we're talking about, and in the deep water plumes, the concentrations are quite low, you know, parts per billion once you get away from the wellhead 5 kilometers or further out, and those sorts of levels aren't going to cause problems with, for example, oxygen. The dissolved gases are a totally different story. There's a tremendous amount of gas in the water.
Yeah, well, in fact, we've got people also coming to us on the show here and asking specifically about methane gas. That's a big concern.
Yes, I have been talking about methane for months now, and you know, none of the NOAA vessels that have been monitoring out around the spill zone have been collecting samples for methane gas measurements. Why is that? This 40% of the flux from this well is gases, and yet those hydrocarbons aren't being measured, and they're not even mentioned in the report.
Bob Deans, I want to come back to you quickly for a comment about the oyster beds. I know that that's something that you've been following particularly closely.
Well, the oystermen down here, you know, Frank, 70% of the shrimp and oysters that we produce in this country come from the Gulf of Mexico, and these estuaries are absolutely a foundational life for that. So these guys are worried. I talked to the head of the Louisiana Oystermen's Association just last week. They're really worried about this. They're losing their oysters. It takes between 3 to 5 years for an oyster to come back. After something like Katrina, they were just beginning to come back from that, and now they're being devastated. And I think for them what's been confusing about this is this from the get-go has been defined by unanswered questions and misinformation. We were told first it was 42,000 gallons of oil a day. We found out it's 2 million. It took us 3 months to figure that out, 3 months to figure out how to cap the well. So now when they hear this kind of specificity being attached to an estimate for how much oil is left in the water, they're a little skeptical.
All right, I want to go to our first caller here. Chris is calling in from Indianapolis. Go ahead, Chris. Thanks for waiting.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, you guys. It's a great subject. I know we don't want this subject, but according to Rush Limbaugh, you know, if you listen to him, he's saying the phones are still flipping and the whales are still doing what they're supposed to be doing. So when you have people talking, spurring that type of information out there to the public, you know, it makes it hard for people who are in trouble and need that fresh water to have everybody to stay serious on the subject.
To try to sort through it. Yeah, yeah. Well, let's go to Dr. Joy. You're a professor in the Department of Marine Sciences, and well, let's focus on the science here for a minute. What should people be thinking? How should they be thinking about the threat to marine life and what Rush is saying versus what the scientists are saying? Is it the same thing?
It's not the same thing because, you know, quite simply, it's too early to know what the impacts are going to be. Many of the food web trophic level impacts are not going to be apparent for years. Adult fish species aren't going to be as impacted by oil exposure as juveniles and larval species are going to be, and fish eggs, for example. I think Dr. Lubchenco mentioned that yesterday in her press conference. You know, we simply don't know what the impacts of this spill are going to be, and to pretend that there aren't going to be any is just it's unfair and it's irresponsible.
Joel, you've been covering this for a long time, and I want to just ask you very quickly, and then we're going to take a brief break. How much dispute and debate is there out there right now among scientists, political leaders, oystermen, whom we've heard mentioned here?
You know, I don't know anyone who has said that, you know, there's no impact or that, you know, this is a minor event. I think everyone recognizes it's a disaster, and I think that Dr. Joy is right. There's a lot that's unknown about this still, and it is still kind of early in the scientific investigation of it.
And we're going to take a quick break. As I mentioned, I want to thank our two folks who joined us on the call, Professor Samantha Joy and Bob Deans. When we come back, we're going to hear from the oil industry and how this spill has affected the industry and its future. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. By the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And by the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, making grants to solve social and environmental problems at home and around the world. On the web at hewlett.org. This is NPR.
The story of a 19th century divorce, how a mother's custody battle against her Shaker husband roused the sympathy of the American public, attracted the notice of Thomas Jefferson, and led to the only legislative divorce in New York history. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to the Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno, sitting in for Diane today. We're talking about the oil spill in the Gulf, and more particularly the aftermath, biologically, economically, and on the industry itself. And now we're joined by Rheola Duhr. She is a senior economic advisor with the American Petroleum Institute. And Ms. Duhr, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much.
I want to start by asking you just flat out, what has the petroleum industry learned from this spill, and what will be different?
Well, I think a lot's going to be different moving forward. For one thing, immediately in the wake of the oil spill, we created task forces, two task forces to look at equipment, technology, another one operating procedures, and got back to the Interior Department with recommendations for that. We're also looking at other short and long-term issues related to the well control, stopping and mitigating the product, and the spill response and cleanup. So we are in a learning mode. We are really focused on trying to identify any gaps, anything we can learn from this tragedy, applying those lessons learned to ensure that this never, ever happens again.
Rheola, who is we?
Oh, we. When I say that, the American Petroleum Institute, initially formed these four task forces, drawing from experts from a variety of companies, both in and outside the government, to address each and every one of these issues.
You're an industry group, right?
That's right.
So are the task forces comprised of the oil companies themselves? Is BP part of that task force?
Well, I have to go through each task force. They have different member composition for each, and I can get back. I don't know off the top of my head whether BP was on each one, but we had petroleum engineers from around the world from different companies and different experts addressing each issue. Part of what we do as an organization is regulations and standards, and we have over 500 different regulations and standards that are reviewed constantly by the government. And so we're looking at what can we do better, how can we close any gaps, how can we make this work better moving forward, what are the lessons we're learning, how can we apply them, and how can we ensure that this kind of accident does not happen
again. Can you give us some of the larger conclusions or some of the more significant lessons that you have learned?
Two of the task forces are just forming now, looking at the subsea well control, for example, and we've already seen some of larger players launch a new program in terms of a new rapid development and containment system, and they're going to employ the state-of-the-art of technology in the event that there is another blowout like this. So that's one of the things that they're focused on. How can we mitigate any spill that might occur in the future? So that's
I can give you a quote from Rex Tillerson.
Go ahead. That's Barbara Shook.
I can give you a quote from Rex Tillerson of ExxonMobil. He's the chairman of ExxonMobil, which is leading the effort on this well containment system. And he flat says, "We hope we never have to use it." The exact quote is, "If we all do our jobs properly, this system will never be used."
I think he's absolutely right.
And this extensive experience of industry shows that when the focus remains on safe operations and risk management, tragic incidents like this one we are witnessing in the Gulf of Mexico today should not occur.
But Rayola, let me ask you this, because I think that's a fine thing to say, but I also think that, and I went out to the deep waters for a documentary project that I worked on for CNN just a couple of years ago and was very impressed by the deep water, the drill platform I was on, and the technology involved. But I think the President of the United States on down would say we were all lulled into a false sense of security. This stuff happens. Nobody has repealed the laws of human nature and shortcuts and the laws of physics. And let's understand here just exactly. One of the reasons I think we were all so overwhelmed by the technology is just exactly what is involved. And when you see it, it's breathtaking, okay? You're drilling down through a mile of water or more. You're drilling down through 5 miles of rock where no human being can go. And you know, as we say, stuff happens. So to state from an audience, from an industry point of view, so that this never happens again, I'm just wondering from a risk management and expectations point of view, whether that's even language that should be used, because things will happen in the future as they've happened in the past.
Listen, that is the goal. And when you look at the record in the Gulf of Mexico, we've been there in the deep water for 30 years now. In terms of spill to production ratio, it's 1/1,000th of 1% of what was produced was spilled. It's been a fantastic record. We have thousands of rigs out there. This has been a catastrophe for everyone. This is an event we didn't think as an industry could happen, and it did. We are learning lessons from it. We don't have the full report yet, but when we see a gap, we're going to fill it.
All right, Rayola,
our goal is to never have it happen again.
Let me just ask you one last question, then I know I have to let you go, and I want to get back to our phone callers who are patiently waiting, and that
sure.
is, what do you see as the future for drilling in the deep waters, this problem now, as it gets put into place?
Well, we certainly want to see our folks get back to work as soon as possible and have this moratoria lifted. But we could be facing higher insurance costs, certainly, additional regulation, more stringent drilling practices, and the possibility of taxes and fees. And our concern is that we be able to enhance this offshore operation while not discouraging domestic energy production. And we have to be able to do both and move forward with that.
Rayola Duer, I know you have to go. Senior Economic Advisor for the American Petroleum Institute, I want to thank you for your time and perspective today.
Thank you.
Let's go right to a a question that comes to us, Joel, from a listener, from Richard in Baltimore. Could you please explain what it means for oil to evaporate?
I think that's a question for Dr. Joy or a scientist, but I believe that the oil that we're talking about, it's not a single substance. It's a bewildering array of different molecules, and they behave differently. Some of them do evaporate. Can I just get back to something that Rayola just said, which is that, yes, the oil industry has come together, mostly without BP, and said, we will do better next time. And they'll also say, as Rayola did, look how good our record was before this. Well, in fact, the record before this was not perfect by any means. And my colleague Steve Muffson in the Washington Post had a big front page story talking about all the other spills, other accidents. If you review the literature for the MMS, there have been lots of accidents, people killed, spills. Things have steadily gone wrong. This is not an immaculate industry. And moreover, when you look at the Deepwater Horizon disaster, there were so many things that there was equipment that was faulty. There was the blowout preventer that had been modified. The regulation was almost non-existent. There were all kinds of mistakes made. There were shortcuts all over the place. So I think the question really is, why should the American people have faith in this industry?
Let's go to a call. Janet is calling us now from Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Yes. Hello. Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment. When I heard about the oil industry wanting to start their own nonprofit to help them for future, in case there's a future problems. I believe that a nonprofit is to help those in need. I think it's completely wrong. They shouldn't be allowed to do that. It's like a big tax write-off for them to help themselves clean up their own messes. And that just really disturbed me to hear that.
Barbara Shook, you want to comment on that, please?
Well, I think the point is that they don't intend to make any money off of an incident should one occur. I think that's the point.
All right, let's go to the phone. David joins us now from Keene, New Hampshire. Hi, David. Thanks for being so patient and waiting.
Hello. I just have a quick comment. We had the disaster up in Alaska, which still isn't clean. All those dispersants that I'm understanding that the other countries have banned. Anybody who says it's not that bad and stuff like that, they're just a tool of the devil and a liar, and basically that's it.
Okay, well, let me speak on behalf. Joe, before you do, let me throw in another email that we've got on that same point, which is someone who writes that common sense tells me that millions of gallons of oil dispersants will have an impact. My concern, the listener writes, is that dispersants will keep the harm underwater. Will BP fund extensive research on the long-term environmental impact? So address those things, Joel. What do we know about
that? Actually, BP has said they're going to give $500 million, I believe. I think that's the number, to long-term research. Though, if you're a scientist, do you want to take BP's money to do your scientific research? I think that's going to be kind of a touchy issue for scientists out there, because they don't want to be seen as taking industry money to determine whether or not what the industry does is safe. And getting back to the whole issue of, like, is it not that bad? No one is saying it's not that bad. But it does seem to me that the Gulf of Mexico's natural processes seem to be helping out. I mean, as Dr. Lubchenco said yesterday, Mother Nature is helping diminish some of the impact of this spill. And I think that as those of us who are covering this story, we don't want to tell people that this is the end of the world and the Gulf of Mexico is going to die because of this. And early in the crisis, that sort of apocalyptic scenario was out there. None of us knew how this was going to play out. We talked about the loop current taking oil to the Outer Banks or, practically to Europe. So we're getting something of a better sense now of the scale of it.
If you have a question or a comment, you can call us at 1-800-433-8850. Or you can send it to drshow@wamu.org. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. I'm Frank Sesno. Barbara Shook, here's a question from Arch in Fort Lauderdale, who emails the following. After the well is closed, how long before there's new drilling in the immediate area to try to get back at that particular field? Will it be open for new bidding, or does BP hold the lease for 50 years? Good question. What's next for the oil and gas that we know is there?
That's a question that no one has. Oh, that's a touchy question right now. I don't think BP is going to be active in the Gulf of Mexico for some time. There's some question about whether it will be allowed to operate its existing leases, whether it will be allowed to drill any new wells in the Gulf of Mexico, and some legislation is pending that would deny it the opportunity to drill new wells for, I think, up to 7 years. The company may be forced to turn over its leases to another company and not be allowed to operate in the U.S. offshore waters for some period of time. We know that BP made a very significant discovery. We could tell that. We know from the composition of the hydrocarbons that it's has a large natural gas content, but a high-quality oil content as well.
So, but likely Joel, the question is, what's going to be sitting there for a while?
Well, what's going to happen to this reservoir? It's 100 million barrels.
I think it's going to, number one, nothing is going to happen to this reservoir until that drilling rig is recovered and possibly the bodies of the 11 people killed. And I think that's been lost in a lot of the coverage since the early weeks that we lost 11 people.
Good point. Thank you. Thank you for pointing
and,
that out.
I think that that is just going to sit there for a while. Now, what we don't know is whether this reservoir extends over into other leases that are held by other companies and whether they will take advantage of the opportunity to drill.
In any case, anybody who goes anywhere near this is going to be doing so at some degree of political risk because this reservoir and this well will be watched far more closely than anything else that's happening out in those waters.
Essentially, it is radioactive.
Yeah, right.
Drill at your own risk. Drill at your own political risk.
Exactly. We have on the line now Captain Doug. Anybody called Captain Doug calling in from Miami deserves to go to the head of the line. So, Captain Doug, thanks very much for calling in. What's your question?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm in the sport fishing industry down here. And I have a question and another point to make. And firstly, I hear a lot about the oyster beds and the marine life that resides in the Gulf. However, the pelagic species of fish, specifically the giant bluefin tuna and swordfish, I know, which travel all the way up the eastern coast of the United States, use the Gulf of Mexico as a nursery. And those fish, I know in July, we had them migrate up through the Florida Straits, where they had just been in the Gulf breeding. So I don't think that we're going to really see and have any idea how badly we've decimated their stocks for years.
How concerned are you about that as a sport fisherman?
Oh, hugely. That's our industry there, and that's not just going to affect the fishermen, but it's going to affect every sushi restaurant, and fishermen all the way up the East Coast of the United States. These aren't fish that reside in the Gulf, like I said. These are fish that breed there and then swim everywhere else.
Joel Achenbach?
I'm glad you mentioned the bluefin because I believe they are heavily threatened species because of their desirability for sushi, and obviously they're a sport fish too, as I understand it. And maybe this disaster in the Gulf will make people pay attention not only to the threat of oil in the water, but also over harvesting of some of these stocks.
While we're down in Florida, let's go to another Florida caller, Jim from Tallahassee. Hi, Jim.
I'm just wondering, this incident happened in Norway and I believe in Canada. The release well would have already been in place, and we are still drilling the release wells in the Gulf. I'm wondering why the industry doesn't step up and make that a standard.
In other words, drill relief wells for all of the wells.
Have them in place. Have them in place before the well opens.
Barbara, very briefly, because I need to take a quick break. You want to answer that question?
No, Canada does not at this time require relief wells to be drilled simultaneously with an exploratory well, nor does Norway.
And so to the question, why not have this be standard operating procedure?
It hasn't been deemed to be necessary up until this point, and Canada recently allowed Chevron to drill a deep water exploratory well off Newfoundland without a relief well being drilled simultaneously.
I mean, you're talking about these are $100 million operations. The relief well, if you want to pay a lot more for gasoline, maybe that'll become part of the law.
Yeah, well, right, sure. But if you want to pay a lot more for cleanups like this, would be the caller's point, I think, is what do you have to do for the next level of insurance policy in terms of drilling relief wells or having them ready?
This went to the Canadian national government as well as the government of Newfoundland and Labrador. They reviewed it with Chevron, and they just believed that it was not necessary to ask Chevron and partners to go to the additional expense of simultaneously drilling a relief well in a high-risk exploratory situation.
Our thanks to Joel Achenbach, reporter with The Washington Post, and also to Barbara Shook, the Houston Bureau Chief and Reporter-at-Large for the Energy Intelligence Group, and to our other experts and biologists who've joined us here today as we've been talking about the impact of the Gulf oil spill. I'm Frank Sesno, in for Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.